Disc 4.
Chapter 12. Vienna. Security at the vaguely named wartime claims and inquiries had always been strict, long before the war in the territories. Located in a former apartment building in Vienna's old Jewish quarter, its door was virtually unmarked and heavily fortified, and the windows overlooking the destitute interior courtyard were bulletproof. The executive director of the organization, a man called Eli Lavon, was not paranoid, just prudent. Over the years, he had helped track down a half-dozen former concentration camp guards and a senior Nazi official living comfortably in Argentina. For his efforts, he had been rewarded with a constant stream of death threats. That he was Jewish was a given. That he was Jewish was a given. That he was of Israeli origin was assumed because of his non-German family name. That he had worked briefly for Israel's secret intelligence service was known by no one in Vienna, and only a handful of people in Tel Aviv, most of whom had long since retired. During the Wrath of God operation, Lavon had been an ayin, a tracker. He had stalked members of Black September, learned their habits, and devised ways of killing them. Under normal circumstances, no one was admitted into the offices of wartime claims and inquiries without a long scheduled appointment and a thorough background check. For Gabriel, all formalities were waived, and he was escorted directly to Lavon's office by a young female researcher. The room was classic Viennese in its proportions and furnishings: a high ceiling, polished wood floor, bookshelves bent beneath the weight of countless volumes and files. Lavon was kneeling on the floor, his back hunched over a line of aging documents. He was an archaeologist by training and had spent years digging in the West Bank before devoting himself fully to his present line of work. Now he was gazing at a sheet of tattered paper with the same wonder he felt while examining a fragment of pottery 5 millennia old. He looked up as Gabriel entered the room and greeted him with a mischievous smile. Lavon cared nothing of his appearance, and as usual he seemed to have dressed in whatever had been within easy reach when he rolled out of bed: grey corduroy trousers and a brown V-neck sweater with tattered elbows. His tousled grey hair gave him the appearance of a man who had just driven at high speed in a convertible. Lavon did not own a car and did almost nothing quickly. Despite his security concerns, he was a dutiful rider of Vienna's streetcars. Public transport did not bother him. Like the men he hunted, Lavon was skilled in the art of moving through city streets unseen. "Let me guess," Lavon said, dropping his cigarette into a coffee cup and struggling to his feet like a man suffering chronic pain. "Shamron pulled you in to investigate Benny's death, and now you're here, which means you've found something interesting."
"Something like that."
"Sit down," Lavon said. "Tell me everything." Sprawled on Lavon's overstuffed green couch, feet propped on the arm, Gabriel gave him a careful account of his investigation, beginning with his visit to Munich and concluding with his meeting with Rabbi Zoli in the ghetto of Venice. Lavon walked back and forth along the length of the room, trailing cigarette smoke like a steam engine. He moved slowly at first, but as Gabriel's story wore on, his pace increased. When he finished, Lavon stopped walking and shook his head.
"My goodness, but you've been a busy boy."
"What does it all mean, Eli?"
"Let's go back to the telephone call you received at the hotel in Brinzone. Who do you think it was?"
"If I had to guess, it was the handyman at the convent, an old fellow named Licio. He came into the room while Sister Vincenza and I were speaking, and I think he was following me through the town after I left.
I wonder why he left an anonymous message instead of speaking to you."
"Maybe he was frightened."
"That would be the logical explanation."
Lavon shoved his hands in his pockets and stared at the high ceiling.
"You're sure about the name he told you? You're sure it was Martin Luther?"
"That's right. Find Sister Regina and Martin Luther. Then you'll know the truth about what happened at the convent." Lavon unconsciously smoothed his unruly hair. It was a habit when he was thinking.
"There are two possibilities that spring to mind. I suppose we can rule out a certain German monk who turned the Roman Catholic Church on its ear. That would narrow the field to one. I'll be right back.
He disappeared into an adjoining room. For the next several minutes, Gabriel was treated to the familiar sound of his old friend rifling through file cabinets and cursing in several different languages. Finally, he returned with a thick accordion file bound by a heavy metal clasp. He laid the file on the coffee table in front of Gabriel and turned it so he could read the label. Martin Luther, German Foreign Office, 1938 to 1943. Lavon opened the file and removed a photograph, holding it up for Gabriel to see.
"The other possibility," he said, "is this Martin Luther. He was a high school dropout and furniture mover who joined the Nazi party in the 20s. By chance, he met the wife of Joachim von Ribbentrop during the redecoration of her villa in Berlin. Luther ingratiated himself with Frau von Ribbentrop, then her husband. When Ribbentrop became foreign minister in 1938, Luther got a job at the ministry."
Gabriel took the photograph from Lavon and looked at it. A rodent of a man stared back at him, a slack face, thick glasses that magnified a pair of rheumy eyes. He handed the photo back to Lavon.
"Luther rose rapidly through the ranks of the Foreign Office, largely because of his slavish devotion to Ribbentrop. By 1940 he was chief of the Abteilung Deutschland, the Division Germany. That made Luther responsible for all Foreign Office business connected to Nazi Party affairs. Included in Luther's Abteilung Deutschland was a department called D3, the Jewish desk."
"So what you're saying is that Martin Luther was in charge of Jewish matters inside the German Foreign Office?"
"Precisely," Lavon said. "What Luther lacked in education and intelligence, he made up for in ruthlessness and ambition. He was interested in only one thing, increasing his own personal power. When it became clear to him that the annihilation of the Jews was a top priority of the regime, he set out to make certain that the Foreign Office wasn't going to be left out of the action. His reward was an invitation to the most despicable luncheon in history."
Lavon paused for a moment to leaf through the contents of the file. After a moment, he found what he was looking for, removed it with a flourish, and laid it on the coffee table in front of Gabriel.
"This is the protocol from the Wannsee Conference, prepared and drafted by its organizer, none other than Adolf Eichmann. Only 30 copies were made. All were destroyed but one, copy number 16. It was discovered after the war, during the preparation for the Nuremberg trials, and resides in the archives of the German Foreign Ministry in Bonn. This, of course, is a photocopy."
Lavon picked up the document.
"The meeting was held in a villa overlooking the Wannsee in Berlin on January the 20th, 1942. It lasted 90 minutes. There were 15 participants. Eichmann served as host and made sure his guests were well fed. Heydrich served as master of ceremonies. Contrary to popular myth, the Wannsee Conference was not the place where the idea of the final solution was hatched. Hitler and Himmler had already decided that the Jews of Europe were to be exterminated. The Wannsee Conference was more like a bureaucratic planning session, a discussion of how the various departments of the Nazi Party and the German government could work together to facilitate the Holocaust."
Lavon handed the documents to Gabriel.
"Look at the list of participants. Recognize any of the names?"
Gabriel cast his eyes down the attendees. Gauleiter Dr. Meyer and Reichsamtleiter Dr. Leibrandt, Reich Minister for the Occupied Eastern Territories. Staatssekretär Dr. Stuckart, Reich Ministry of the Interior. Staatssekretär Neumann, Plenipotentiary for the Four-Year Plan. Staatssekretär Dr. Freisler, Reich Minister of Justice. Staatssekretär Dr. Bühler, Office of the General Government. Understaatssekretär Dr. Luther, Foreign Office. Gabriel looked up at Lavon. Luther was at Wannsee?
"Indeed he was, and he got exactly what he so desperately wanted. Heydrich mandated that the Foreign Office would play a pivotal role in facilitating deportations of Jews from countries allied with Nazi Germany and from German satellites, such as Croatia and Slovakia." I thought the SS handled the deportation. Let me back up a moment.
Levon leaned over the coffee table and placed his hands on the surface, as though it were a map of Europe.
The vast majority of Holocaust victims were from Poland, the Baltics, and Western Russia, places conquered and ruled directly by the Nazis. They rounded up Jews and slaughtered them at will, without any interference from other governments, because there were no other governments.
Levon paused, one hand sliding over the imaginary map to the south, the other to the west.
But Heydrich and Eichmann weren't satisfied with murdering only the Jews under direct German rule. They wanted every Jew in Europe, 11 million in all.
Levon tapped his right forefinger on the table.
The Jews in the Balkans, he tapped his left forefinger, and the Jews in Western Europe. In most of these places, they had to deal with local governments to pry the Jews loose for deportation and extermination. Luther's section of the Foreign Office was responsible for that. It was Luther's job to deal with the local governments on a ministry-to-ministry basis, to make certain that the deportations went smoothly and all diplomatic niceties were adhered to. And he was damned good at it.
For argument's sake, let's assume the old man was referring to this, Martin Luther. What would he have been doing at the convent in northern Italy? Levon shrugged his narrow shoulders.
It sounds to me as if the old man was trying to tell you that something happened at the convent during the war, something that Sister Vincenza is trying to cover up, something that Benny knew about.
Something that got him killed. Levon shrugged.
Maybe.
Who would be willing to kill a man over a book? Levon hesitated, taking a moment to slip the protocol of the Wannsee conference back into the file. Then he looked up at Gabriel, eyes narrowed, and drew a deep breath.
There was one government in particular that Eichmann and Luther were concerned about. It maintained diplomatic relations with both the Allies and Nazi Germany during the war. It had representatives in all of the countries where the roundups and deportations were taking place, representatives who could have made the task more difficult had they chosen to forcefully intervene. For obvious reasons, Eichmann and Luther considered it critical that this government not raise objections. Hitler considered this government so pivotal that he dispatched the second-ranking official at the Foreign Office, Baron Ernst von Weizsäcker, to serve as his ambassador. Do you know which government I'm talking about, Gabriel?
Gabriel closed his eyes. The Vatican.
Indeed.
So who are the clowns that have been following me?
That's a very good question.
Gabriel crossed the room to Levon's desk, lifted the receiver of the telephone, and dialed a number. Levon did not need to ask who Gabriel was calling. He could see it in the determined set of his jaw and the tension in his hands. When a man is being stalked by an enemy he does not know, it is best to have a friend who knows how to fight dirty. The man standing on the steps of Vienna's famed concert house radiated open-air Austrian good looks and Viennese sophistication. Had anyone spoken to him, he would have replied in perfect German, with the lazy inflection of a well-heeled young man who had spent many happy hours sampling the bohemian delights of Vienna. He was not Austrian, nor had he been raised in Vienna. His name was Ephraim ben Avraham, and he had spent his childhood in a dusty settlement deep in the Negev, a place far removed from the world in which he moved now. He glanced casually at his watch, then surveyed the expanse of the Beethovenplatz. He was on edge, more so than usual. It was a simple job. Meet an agent, deliver him safely to the communications room of the embassy. But the man he was meeting was no ordinary agent. The Vienna station chief had made the stakes clear to Ben Avraham before dispatching him. If you fuck it up, Ari Shamron will track you down and strangle you with one of his patented death grips. And whatever you do, don't try to talk to the agent. He's not the most approachable of men. Ben Avraham stuck an American cigarette between his lips and ignited it. It was at that moment, through the dancing blue flame of his lighter, that Ben Avraham saw the legend emerge from the darkness. He dropped his cigarette to the wet pavement and ground it out with the toe of his shoe, watching while the agent made two complete circuits of the square.
No one was following him, no one but the disheveled little man with flyaway hair and a wrinkled coat. He was a legend, too. Eli Lavon, surveillance artist extraordinaire. Ben Avraham had met him once at the academy when Lavon had been a guest lecturer at a seminar on man-to-man street work. He had kept the recruits up till 3 in the morning, telling war stories about the dark days of the Black September operation. Ben Avraham watched the pair in admiration for a moment as they drifted among the evening crowd like synchronized swimmers. Their routine was by the book, but it had a certain flair and precision that came from working together in situations where one misstep could cost one of them his life. Finally, the young officer started down the steps toward his target.
"Herr Müller," he called out. The legend looked up. "So good to see you."
Lavon vanished as though stepping through a stage curtain. Ben Avraham hooked his fingers inside the elbow of the legend and pulled him toward the darkened footpaths of the Stadtpark. They walked in circles for 10 minutes, diligently checking their tail. He was smaller than Ben Avraham expected, lean and spare, like a cyclist. It was difficult to imagine that this was the same man who had liquidated half of Black September, the same man who had walked into a villa in Tunis and gunned down Abu Jihad, the second-ranking leader of the PLO, in front of his wife and children. The legend said nothing. It was as if he were listening for his enemies. His footfalls on the pavement of the pathways made no sound. It was like walking next to a ghost. The car was waiting a block from the park. Ben Avraham climbed behind the wheel, and for 20 minutes wound his way around the city center. The station chief was right. He was not a man who invited small talk. Indeed, the only time he spoke was to politely ask Ben Avraham to extinguish his cigarette. His German had the hard edge of a Berliner. Satisfied that no one was following, Ben Avraham turned into a narrow street in northeast Vienna called the Anton Frank Gasse. The building at number 20 had been the target of numerous terror attacks over the years and was heavily fortified. It was also under constant surveillance by the Austrian secret services. As the car slipped into the entrance of the underground parking garage, the legend ducked below the dashboard. For an instant, his head pressed lightly against Ben Avraham's leg. His scalp was burning, like a man in the grip of a death fever. The secure communications room was located in a soundproof glass cubicle 2 levels below ground. It took several minutes for the operator in Tel Aviv to patch the call through to Shamron's home in Tiberias. Over the scrambler, his voice sounded as if it was emanating from the bottom of a steel drum. In the background, Gabriel heard water running into a basin and the tinkle of cutlery against china. He could almost picture Shamron's long-suffering wife, Geula, washing dishes in the kitchen sink. Gabriel gave Shamron the same briefing he had given earlier to Lavon. When he finished, Shamron asked what he planned to do next. "I thought I'd go to London and ask Peter Malone why Benny called him from a hotel in Brenzone."
"Malone? What makes you think he'll talk? Peter Malone is in business for himself. If he's actually got something, he'll sit on it harder than even poor Benny."
"I'm working on a subtle way to make my approach."
"And if he's not interested in opening his notebook to you?"
"Then I'll try a not-so-subtle approach."
"I don't trust him."
"He's the only lead I have at the moment."
Shamron sighed heavily. Despite the distance and the scrambler, Gabriel could hear an edgy rattle in his chest.
"I want the meeting done the right way," Shamron said. "No more wandering into situations blind and without backup. He gets surveillance before and after. Otherwise, you can wash your hands of this thing and go back to Venice to finish your Bellini."
"If you insist."
"Helpful suggestions are not my way. I'll contact London Station tonight and put a man on him. Keep me informed."
Gabriel hung up the phone and stepped outside into the corridor. Ephraim Ben Avraham was waiting.
"Where now?"
the young field man asked.
Gabriel looked at his watch. "Take me to the airport."
Chapter 13. London. On his second day in London, Gabriel visited a used bookstore in the Charing Cross Road at dusk and purchased a single volume. He tucked it beneath his arm and walked to the Leicester Square underground station. At the entrance he removed the well-worn dust jacket and tossed it into a rubbish bin. Inside the station he bought a ticket from the automated dispenser and rode the long escalator down to the Northern Line platform, where he endured an obligatory 10-minute delay. He used the time to leaf through the book. When he found the passage he was looking for, he circled it in red ink and folded the page to mark the place. The train finally grumbled into the station. Gabriel squeezed into the crowded carriage and wound his arm around a metal pole. His destination was Sloane Square, which required a change of trains at the embankment. As the train jerked forward, he looked down at the faded gold lettering on the spine of the book. The Deceivers. Peter Malone. Malone, one of the most dreaded names in London. Revealer of personal and professional misdeeds, destroyer of lives and careers. An investigative reporter for the Sunday Times, Malone's list of victims was long and diverse. Two cabinet ministers, the second-ranking official at MI5, a slew of crooked businessmen, even the editor-in-chief of a rival newspaper. During the past decade, he had also published a string of sensational biographies and political exposés. The Deceivers dealt with the exploits of the office. It had caused something of a firestorm in Tel Aviv, largely because of its telling accuracy. It included the revelation that Ari Shamron had recruited a spy from the senior ranks of MI6. The crisis that followed, Shamron would later say, was the worst between the British and the Jews since the bombing of the King David Hotel. 10 minutes later, Gabriel was walking through the streets of Chelsea in the gathering darkness, Malone's book under his arm. He crossed Cadogan Square and paused in front of the handsome white Georgian townhouse. Lights were burning in the second-floor windows. He climbed the steps to the front door, laid the book on a braided straw mat, then turned and walked quickly away. Parked on the opposite side of the square was a grey commercial van of American manufacture. When Gabriel tapped on the blacked-out rear window, the door swung open, revealing a darkened interior lit only by the soft glow of an instrument panel. Sitting before the console was a reedy, rabbinical-looking boy named Mordecai. He offered Gabriel a bony hand and pulled him inside. Gabriel closed the door and crouched next to him. The floor was littered with grease-spotted panini wrappers and empty styrofoam cups. Mordecai had been living in the van for most of the past 36 hours. "How many people in the house?" Gabriel asked. Mordecai reached out and turned a knob. Over the speakers, Gabriel could hear the faint voice of Peter Malone talking to one of his assistants. 3, Mordecai said. "Malone and 2 girls. Gabriel dialed Malone's number. The ringing of his office telephone sounded like a fire alarm over Mordecai's speakers. The surveillance man reached out and turned down the volume. After 3 rings, the reporter answered and identified himself by name in a soft Scottish brogue. Gabriel spoke English and made no attempt to conceal his Israeli accent. "I just left a copy of your latest book outside your door. I suggest you take a look at it. I'll call you back in exactly 5 minutes." Gabriel rang off and rubbed a clear patch on the fogged glass of the window. The front door opened a few inches, and Malone, turtle-like, poked out his head. It swiveled from side to side as he searched in vain for the man who had just telephoned. Then he bent down and scooped up the book. Gabriel looked at Mordecai and smiled. Victory. 5 minutes later, he pressed the redial button on his phone. This time Malone answered on the first ring. "Who are you? Did you see the passage I circled in the book? The Abu Jihad assassination. What about it?" "I was there that night." "For which side?" "The good guys." "So you're a Palestinian?" "No, Abu Malone, I'm not a Palestinian." "Who are you then?" "I'm the agent who was codenamed Sword." "Good Lord," Malone whispered. "Where are you? What do you want?" "I want to talk to you." "About what?" "Benjamin Stern." A long pause. "I have nothing to say to you." Gabriel decided to push a little harder. "We found your telephone number among his things. We know you were working with him on his book. We think you might know who killed him and why." Another long silence while Malone pondered his next move. Gabriel's use of the pronoun we was quite deliberate, and it had its intended effect.
And if I do know something, I'd like to compare notes.
And what do I get in return?
Malone, ever the alert reporter, was going to make Gabriel sing for his supper.
I'll talk to you about that night in Tunis, Gabriel said, then added, and others like it.
Are you serious?
Benjamin was my friend. I'd do almost anything to find the men who killed him.
Then you have a deal.
Malone's tone was suddenly brisk. How do you want to go about this?
Are there assistants in the house?
Gabriel asked, though he knew the answer already.
Two girls.
Get rid of them. Leave the front door unlatched. When I see them go, I'll come inside. No tape recorders, no cameras, no fucking around. Do you understand me?
Gabriel killed the connection before the reporter could answer, then slipped the telephone into his pocket. 2 minutes later, the front door opened and a pair of young women stepped outside. When they were gone, Gabriel climbed out of the van and walked across the square toward the house. The front door was unlocked, just as he had instructed. He turned the latch and stepped inside. They appraised each other across the marble entrance hall like captains of opposing football teams. Gabriel could see why it was difficult to watch British television without seeing Malone's face, and why he was considered one of London's most eligible bachelors. He was trim and fine-boned, immaculately dressed in wool trousers and a cardigan sweater the colour of claret wine. Gabriel, dressed in jeans and a leather jacket, his face concealed behind a pair of sunglasses and a ball cap, seemed a man from the wrong side of town. Malone did not offer Gabriel his hand.
You can take off that ridiculous disguise. I'm not in the habit of betraying sources.
If you don't mind, I prefer to keep it on.
Suit yourself? Coffee? Something stronger?
No, thank you.
My office is upstairs. I think you'll find it comfortable.
It was an old drawing room, long and rectangular, with floor-to-ceiling bookshelves and oriental carpets. In the center of the room were two antique library tables, one for Malone, another for his research assistants. Malone switched off the computer and sat down in one of the wing chairs next to the gas fire, motioning for Gabriel to do the same.
I must say, it is rather bizarre to actually be in the same room with you. I've heard so much about your exploits that I feel I actually know you. You're quite the legend. Black September, Abu Jihad, and countless others in between. Have you killed anyone lately?
When Gabriel did not rise to the bait, Malone carried on.
While I find you morbidly fascinating, I must admit that I find the things you've done to be morally repugnant. In my opinion, a state which resorts to assassination as a matter of policy is no better than the enemy it's trying to defeat. In many respects, it's worse. You're a murderer in my book, just so you understand where I'm coming from.
Gabriel began to wonder whether he had made a mistake by coming here. He had learned long ago that arguments like this could never be won. He'd had too many, just like it with himself. He sat very still, gazing at Peter Malone through his dark glasses, waiting for him to come to the point. Malone crossed his legs and picked a bit of lint from his trousers. It was a gesture that betrayed anxiety. This pleased Gabriel.
"Perhaps we should finalize the details of our arrangement before we proceed," Malone said. "I will tell you what I know about Benjamin Stern's murder. In return, you'll grant me an interview. Obviously, I've written about intelligence matters before, and I know the rules. I will do nothing to reveal your true identity, nor will I write anything that will compromise current operations.
Do we have a deal?"
"We do."
Malone spent a moment gazing up at the recessed lighting, then looked down at Gabriel.
"You're right about Benjamin. I was working with him on his book. Our partnership was supposed to be confidential. I'm surprised you were able to find me."
"Why did Benjamin come to you?"
Malone stood up and walked over to the bookshelves. He removed a volume and handed it to Gabriel. "Crux Vera, the KGB of the Catholic Church."
"Benjamin had something big, something dealing with the Vatican and the war."
Gabriel held up the book.
"Something dealing with Crux Vera.
Malone nodded. Your friend was a brilliant academic, but he didn't know the first thing about investigating a story. He asked me if I would work for him as a consultant and investigator in all matters dealing with crooks of error. I agreed, and we negotiated compensation. The money was to be paid half in advance and half on completion and acceptance of the manuscript. Needless to say, I only received the first payment.
What did he have?
Unfortunately, I wasn't privy to that information. Your friend played things very close to the vest. If I didn't know better, I would have thought he was one of your crowd.
What did he want from you?
Access to material I'd gathered while writing the Crux Vera book. Also, he wanted me to try to track down two priests who worked at the Vatican during the war.
What were their names?
Monsignors Cesare Felici and Tommaso Manzini.
Did you ever find them?
I tried, Malone said. What I discovered is that they were both missing and presumed dead. And there's something even more interesting than that. The detective from the Rome headquarters of the Polizia di Stato, who was investigating the cases, was removed by his superiors and reassigned.
Do you know the investigator's name?
Alessio Rossi, but for God's sake, don't tell him I gave you his name. I have a reputation to protect.
If you know so much, why haven't you written anything?
What I have now is a series of murders and disappearances which I believe are linked, yet I haven't a shred of hard evidence conclusively linking them in any way. The last thing I want to do is accuse the Vatican or someone close to the Vatican of murder without a damned solid case. Besides, no decent editor would touch it.
But you have a theory about who might be behind it.
What you have to remember is that we're talking about the Vatican, Malone said. Men linked to that venerable institution have been involved in intrigues and plots for nearly two millennia. They play the game better than anyone, and in the past, religious fervor and battles over doctrine have induced them to commit the mortal sin of murder. The church is riddled with secret societies and cliques who might be involved in something like this.
Who? Gabriel repeated.
Peter Malone flashed a television smile.
In my humble opinion, you hold the answer in your hand.
Gabriel looked down. Crux Vera, the KGB of the Catholic Church. Malone left the room, returning a moment later with a bottle of Medoc and a pair of large crystal goblets. He poured two generous measures and handed one to Gabriel.
Do you speak Latin?
Actually, we speak another ancient language. Malone grinned at Gabriel over his wine glass and continued on. Crux Vera is Latin for the True Cross. It is also the name of an ultra-secret order within the Roman Catholic Church, a sort of church within a church. If you look in the Annuario Pontificio, the Vatican yearbook, you'll find no mention of Crux Vera. If you ask the Vatican press office, you will be told that it is a fabrication, a sort of blood libel spread by the enemies of the church in order to discredit it. But, if you ask me, Crux Vera does exist, and I proved it in that book, regardless of what the Vatican says. I believe the tentacles of Crux Vera reach to the highest levels of the Vatican, and that its adherents occupy positions of power and influence around the globe.
What is it, exactly?
The group was created during the Spanish Civil War by an anti-communist priest named Juan Antonio Rodriguez. Monsignor Rodriguez was very selective about the type of people he permitted to join. The vast majority of his recruits were laymen. Most were wealthy or politically connected. Bankers, lawyers, industrialists, government ministers, spies, and secret policemen. You see, Rodriguez was never interested in the business of saving souls. In his opinion, that sort of thing could be left to ordinary parish priests. Rodriguez was interested in only one thing, protecting the Roman Catholic Church from its mortal enemies.
And who were they?
The Bolsheviks, Malone said, then quickly added, and the Jews, of course. Crux Vera spread quickly across Europe throughout the 30s. It established beachheads in France, Italy, Germany, the Balkans, and the Roman Curia itself. During the war, members of Crux Vera worked in the papal household and the Secretariat of State. As Kreuzwehr expanded, so did Monsignor Rodriguez's mission. He was no longer satisfied simply with protecting the church from its enemies. He wanted to return the church to the position of absolute power and supremacy that it enjoyed during the Middle Ages. That remains the core mission of Kreuzwehr to this day, reversing the defeats of the Reformation and the Enlightenment, and making the state subservient to the church once again. They also want to undo what they view as the heretical reforms of the Second Vatican Council, Vatican II. How do they intend to do that? Kreuzwehr may have loathed the KGB, but in many ways it is an exact replica, hence the title of my book. It wages a secret war against those it deems enemies, and acts like a secret police force within the church, enforcing strict adherence to doctrine and crushing dissent. Oh, the dissidents and reformers are allowed to vent their spleen now and again, but if they ever pose a real threat, Kreuzwehr will step in and help them see the light. And if they refuse to yield? Let's just say that several people who have run afoul of Kreuzwehr have died under less than clear circumstances. Prelates who have dared to oppose Kreuzwehr have fallen victim to sudden heart attacks. Journalists who have tried to investigate the order have disappeared or committed suicide. So have members of Kreuzwehr who've tried to leave. How does a religious order justify the use of violence? The priests of Kreuzwehr aren't the ones who are resorting to violence. The priests give guidance, but it's the laymen who actually do the dirty work. Inside the order, they're known as Milites Christi, the soldiers of Christ. They're encouraged to engage in pilleria, or dirty tricks to achieve the goals of the order. Pilleria can be anything from blackmail to murder. And when the act is done, the priests provide absolution in the secrecy of the confessional. By the way, Milites Christi aren't permitted to confess to anyone but a Kreuzwehr priest. That way, unpleasant secrets stay inside the family. How do they feel about the current pope? From what I hear, they're lukewarm, to say the least. Pope Paul VII talks about rebirth and renewal. To Kreuzwehr, these words mean reform and liberalization, and they get nervous. What makes you think Kreuzwehr was involved in Benjamin's murder? They might have had a motive. If there's one thing Kreuzwehr detests, it's revelations of the Vatican's dirty laundry. The order sees itself first and foremost as a guardian of the church. If your friend had proof of something damaging, he would have fallen into the category of enemy, and Kreuzwehr would have seen it as their duty to deal with him harshly, for the greater good of the church, of course. Malone finished his glass of wine and poured himself another. Gabriel's glass remained untouched. If you've been talking to people, asking questions, poking your nose into affairs that don't concern you, it's quite possible you've already appeared on Kreuzwehr's radar. If they think you pose a threat, they won't hesitate to kill you. I appreciate your candor. And we had a deal. Malone picked up a notepad and a pen, and suddenly the roles were reversed. It's my turn to ask the questions now. Just remember the rules, if you betray me. Don't worry. I'm also aware of the fact that Kreuzwehr is not the only secret organization to engage in pilleria. Malone licked his forefinger and turned to a fresh page in his notebook. My God, I have so many questions, I don't know where to begin. Gabriel spent the next 2 hours unenthusiastically holding up his end of the bargain. Finally, he saw himself out the front door of Peter Malone's house and struck out across Cadogan Square in a steady rain. On Sloane Street, he pulled his cellular phone from his pocket and dialed Mordecai in the surveillance van. "Keep monitoring him," Gabriel said. "If he goes anywhere, go with him." Peter Malone sat before the computer in his upstairs office, feverishly typing up his notes. He could not quite believe his good fortune. He had learned, long ago, that success was the result of a volatile combination of hard work and pure luck. Sometimes good stories just fell into one's lap. The difference between an average journalist and a great one is what he did next. After an hour of steady work, his handwritten notes had been transformed into a pair of organized memos. The first dealt with the exploits of the agent, codenamed Sword.
The second was an account of their discussion regarding Benjamin Stern. Whether it was his intention or not, the Israeli had just given Malone the hook he needed for his story. Israeli intelligence was investigating the murder of prominent historian Benjamin Stern. He would ring Tel Aviv in the morning, secure the mandatory denial from the drones at headquarters, then stitch together the other mysterious details he knew about the case. He had not told the Israeli everything he knew about Stern's murder, just as he was quite certain the Israeli had not shared all of his knowledge. That's the way the game was played. It took an experienced reporter to know the difference between truth and misinformation, to sift through the silt to find the nuggets of gold. With a bit of luck, he might have a piece ready by the weekend. He spent a few minutes double-checking the quotes. He decided he would call Tom Graves, his editor at the Sunday Times, and reserve some space on the front page. He reached out for the telephone, but before he could lift the receiver from the cradle, he was flung backward by a blow to the chest. He looked down and saw a small, rapidly spreading circle of blood on his shirt. Then he looked up and saw the man, standing 5 feet from his desk, grey-blonde hair, colourless eyes. Malone had been so engrossed in his work that he had failed to hear him enter the house.
"Why?"
the reporter whispered, blood in his mouth. The killer tilted his head, as though puzzled, and stepped around the desk. "Ego te absolvo a peccatis tuis," he said, fingers caressing the forehead, "in nomine Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti. Amen." Then he pointed the silenced gun at Malone's head and fired one last shot. In the lexicon of The Office, the device that the surveillance artist called Mordecai had placed in Malone's office was known as a glass. Concealed within the electronics of the telephone, it provided coverage of Malone's calls, as well as conversations taking place inside the room. It had allowed Mordecai to monitor Gabriel's conversation with Malone. He had also listened in as Malone sat at his desk after Gabriel's departure, tapping away at his computer. Shortly after 9 o'clock, Mordecai heard murmuring in a language he could not understand. For the next 5 minutes, he was treated to the sound of file drawers opening and closing. He assumed it was Malone, but when the front door opened and a tall, broad-shouldered man emerged, Mordecai knew at once that something terrible had just taken place inside the house. The man walked quickly down the steps and started across the square, directly toward the van. Mordecai panicked. The only weaponry he had was a directional microphone and a long-lens Nikon camera. It was the Nikon he reached for. As the man drew closer to the van, Mordecai raised it calmly to his eye and snapped off 3 quick shots. The last one, he was convinced, was a keeper. Chapter 14. Rome. Vatican City State is the world's smallest country, and also the most sparsely populated. More than 4,000 people work there each day, yet only 400 or so actually live behind the walls. Cardinal Secretary of State Marco Brindisi was one of them. His private apartment in the Apostolic Palace was just one floor away from that of the Holy Father. While some prelates found life in the epicenter of Vatican power the equivalent of living in a gilded cage, Cardinal Brindisi truly relished it. His rooms were glorious, his commute was exceedingly short, and a staff of priests and nuns saw to his every need. If there was one drawback, it was the proximity of the papal household. While inside the palace there was little the cardinal could do to shield himself from the prying eyes of the pope's secretaries. The back room at Lviv was suitable for many of the cardinal's private assignations, though others, like the one scheduled for this evening, had to be held under more secure circumstances. A Mercedes sedan was waiting in the San Damaso courtyard outside the entrance of the Apostolic Palace. Unlike lesser curial cardinals, Brindisi did not have to endure the luck of the draw in the Vatican motor pool. A Mercedes sedan and a driver were permanently assigned to him, along with a vigilanza security man. Brindisi climbed into the back, and the car pulled away. It moved slowly along the Via Belvedere, past the Pontifical Pharmacy and the Swiss Guards barracks, before slipping through St. Anne's Gate into Rome proper. The car crossed the Piazza della Città,
then turned into the entrance of an underground parking garage. The building above was a Vatican-owned residential complex where many curial cardinals lived. There were several others like it scattered around Rome. The car braked to a halt next to a grey Fiat van. As Brindisi climbed out, the van's rear door swung open, and a man lowered himself to the ground. Like Brindisi, he was cloaked in a cassock with a crimson simar and fascia. But unlike the Secretary of State, he had no right to wear it. He was not a cardinal. In fact, he was not even an ordained priest. Cardinal Brindisi did not know the man's name, only that he had worked briefly as an actor before coming to work for the Vigilanza. Brindisi's stand-in stepped out of the shadows and paused for an instant before the cardinal. As always, Brindisi felt a chill at the back of his neck. It was as if he were gazing into a mirror. The features, the round eyeglasses, the gold pectoral cross. The man had even learned to mimic the arrogant angle of Brindisi's zucchetto. A tepid smile flickered over the man's face, a precise imitation of Brindisi's own. Then he said, "Good evening, Eminence."
"Good evening, Eminence," Cardinal Brindisi found himself repeating.
The impersonator nodded tersely, then climbed into the back of Brindisi's staff car and sped away. Father Mascone, Brindisi's private secretary, was waiting in the back of the van.
"Please hurry, Eminence. It's not safe to stay here long."
The priest helped the cardinal into the back of the van and closed the door, then guided him onto an embroidered stool. The van sped back up the ramp and turned into the street. A moment later, it was heading across Rome toward the Tiber. The priest unzipped a garment bag and removed several articles of clothing, a pair of grey trousers, a mock turtleneck pullover, an expensive tan blazer, a pair of black loafers. Cardinal Brindisi loosened his simar and began to undress. After a moment, he was naked except for his underwear and a spiked chain wrapped around his right thigh.
"Perhaps you should remove your cilice," the priest said. "It might show through your trousers."
Cardinal Brindisi shook his head.
"My willingness to shed my vestments goes only so far, Father Mosconi. I will wear my cilice tonight, regardless of whether or not it shows through." He paused. "My trousers."
"Very well, Eminence."
With the priest's help, the cardinal quickly changed into the unfamiliar clothing. When he was fully dressed, he removed his distinctive spectacles and replaced them with a pair of slightly tinted eyeglasses. The transformation was complete. He no longer looked like a prince of the church, but like a well-to-do Roman male of ill repute, perhaps a man who put himself about with younger women. 5 minutes later, in a deserted square on the opposite side of the Tiber, the van came to a stop. The priest opened the door. Cardinal Secretary of State Marco Brindisi made the sign of the cross and stepped out. In many ways, Rome is a company town. Under normal circumstances, Marco Brindisi could not walk the Via Veneto without being recognized, even dressed in the simple black cassock of a parish priest. Tonight, however, he moved unnoticed, slicing his way through the buzzing crowds and past overflowing cafes as though he were just another Roman in search of a good meal and pleasant company. The glory days of the Via Veneto had long since faded. It was still a lovely boulevard, lined with plane trees, exclusive shops, and expensive restaurants, but the intellectuals and movie stars had long ago moved on in search of undiscovered delights. Now the crowd was mainly tourists and businessmen and pretty Italian teenagers careening about on motor scooters. Marco Brindisi had never been seduced by the Via Veneto's Dolce Vita, even in the 60s when he was a young curial bureaucrat, fresh from his Umbrian hill town, and it seemed even less appealing now. The snatches of table conversation drifting past his ears seemed so utterly trivial. He knew that some cardinals, indeed even some popes, liked to walk about Rome in mufti to see how the other half lived. Brindisi had no desire to see how the other half lived. With few exceptions, he found the other half to be an immoral and uncouth rabble, who would be far better off if they listened more to the teachings of the church and less to the incessant blare of their televisions.
An attractive, middle-aged woman in a low-cut dress shot him an admiring glance from a café table. Brindisi, playing the part, smiled back. As he walked on, the cardinal begged Christ's forgiveness and applied pressure to his cilice to increase the pain. He had heard the confessions of priests who had fallen victim to the temptation of sex, priests who kept mistresses, priests who had performed unspeakable acts with other priests. Brindisi had never known such temptations. The moment he entered the seminary, his heart was given over to Christ and the Virgin. Priests who could not keep their vows sickened him. He believed that any priest who could not remain celibate should be defrocked. But he was also a pragmatist, and he realized that such a policy would certainly decimate the ranks of the clergy. The cardinal came to the intersection of the Via Veneto and the Corso d'Italia, and glanced at his watch. He had arrived at precisely the scheduled time. A few seconds later, a car pulled to the curb. The rear door swung open, and Carlo Casagrande climbed out. "Excuse me if I don't kiss your ring," Casagrande said, "but I don't think it would be appropriate under the circumstances. The weather is quite mild this evening. Shall we walk in the Villa Borghese?" Casagrande led the cardinal across the broad boulevard, exposing the second most powerful man in the Catholic Church to the bloodlust of Rome's drivers. Arriving safely at the other side, they strolled along a gravel footpath. Come Sunday, the park would be filled with screaming children and men listening to the soccer matches on portable radios. Tonight it was quiet, except for the swish of traffic along the Corso. The cardinal walked as though he were still wearing crimson, with his hands clasped behind his back and his head down, a rich man who had dropped money and was making a half-hearted effort to find it. When Casagrande whispered that Peter Malone was dead, Brindisi murmured a brief prayer, but resisted the impulse to conclude it with the sign of the cross.
"This assassin of yours is quite efficient," he said.
"Unfortunately, he's had a good deal of practice."
"Tell me about him."
"It's my job to protect you from things like that, Eminence."
"I don't ask out of morbid curiosity, Carlo. My only concern is that this matter is being dealt with in an efficient manner."
They came to the Galleria Borghese. Casagrande sat down on a marble bench in front of the museum and motioned for Brindisi to do the same. The cardinal made a vast show of brushing away the dust before gingerly settling himself on the cold stone. Casagrande then spent the next 5 minutes reluctantly reciting everything he knew about the assassin called the Leopard, beginning with his long and bloody association with left-wing and Palestinian terrorist groups, and concluding with his transformation into a highly paid professional killer. Casagrande had the distinct impression that the cardinal was enjoying his vicarious association with evil.
"His real name?"
"Not clear, Eminence."
"His nationality?"
"The prevailing sentiment among European security officials is that he is Swiss, although that, too, is a matter of some speculation."
"You've actually met this man?"
"We've been in the same room, Eminence. We've done business, but I still wouldn't say that I've actually met him. I doubt whether anyone truly has."
"Is he intelligent?"
"Highly."
"Educated?"
"There is evidence to suggest that he studied theology briefly at the University of Fribourg before he was lured away by the call of leftist violence and terror. There is also evidence to suggest that he attended a novitiate in Zurich when he was a young man."
"You mean to tell me that this monster actually studied for the priesthood?"
Cardinal Brindisi shook his head slowly.
"I don't suppose he still considers himself a Catholic."
"The Leopard? I'm not sure he believes in anything but himself."
"And now a man who once killed for the communists works for Carlo Casagrande, the man who helped the Polish Pope bring down the evil empire."
"Politics, as they say, does make for strange bedfellows."
Casagrande stood up.
"Come, let's walk."
They set out down a path lined with stone pine. The cardinal was taller than the security man by a narrow head. His vestments had the effect of softening his appearance. Dressed as he was now in civilian clothing,
Marco Brindisi was a hard, menacing figure, a man who instilled fear rather than trust. They sat on a bench overlooking the Piazza di Siena. Casagrande thought of his wife, of sitting with her in this very spot and watching the horses parade around the oval track. He could almost smell the strawberries on her hands. Angelina had loved to eat strawberries and drink spumanti in springtime in the Villa Borghese. Cardinal Brindisi shattered Casagrande's unsettling memory by raising the subject of the man known as Ehud Landau. The Vatican security man told the cardinal about Landau's visit to the convent of the Sacred Heart in Brenzone.
"My God," the cardinal murmured beneath his breath, "how did Mother Vincenza hold up?"
"Apparently quite well. She told him the cover story we devised and saw him on his way. But the next morning he returned to the convent and asked about Sister Regina."
"Sister Regina? This is a disaster. How could he have known?"
Casagrande shook his head. It was a question he had been asking himself since Mother Vincenza's second telephone call. How could he have known? Benjamin Stern's apartment had been thoroughly searched. Everything dealing with the convent had been removed and destroyed. Obviously some piece of evidence had slipped through Casagrande's net and landed in the hands of his adversary from Israel.
"Where is he now?"
the cardinal asked. "I'm afraid I haven't a clue. I put a man on him in Brenzone, but he slipped away from him in Verona. He's obviously a trained professional. We haven't heard from him again since."
"How do you plan to deal with him?"
Casagrande turned his gaze from the ancient racetrack and looked into the pale eyes of the cardinal.
"As Secretary of State, you should be aware that the security office has identified a man it believes is intent on assassinating the Holy Father."
"So noted," the cardinal said formally. "What steps have you taken to make certain he does not succeed?"
"I brought Achille Bartoletti into the picture, and he has responded as you might expect. A task force has been formed, and a round-the-clock search for the man is now underway."
"I suppose that at some point the Holy Father will need to be told about this threat as well. Perhaps we can use this information to influence his decision about going to the ghetto next week."
"My thoughts, exactly," Casagrande said. "Is our business concluded?"
"One more item, actually."
The cardinal told Casagrande about the reporter from La Repubblica, who was investigating the Holy Father's childhood.
"Exposure of a Vatican deceit, even a harmless one, would not be a welcome development at this time. See if there's something you can do to put this meddlesome reporter in his place."
"I'll work on it," Casagrande said. "What did you say to the Holy Father?"
"I told him it might be helpful if he prepared a memorandum summarizing the unhappy details of his childhood."
"How did he respond?"
"He agreed, but I don't want to wait for him. I'd like you to pursue your own investigation. It's important that we learn the truth before it's printed in the pages of La Repubblica."
"I'll put a man on it right away."
"Very well," the cardinal said. "Now, I believe, our business is concluded."
"One of my men will be trailing you. At the right moment, the van will appear. It will take you back to the Vatican. Unless you'd like to walk back to the Via Veneto. We could have a glass of Frascati and watch Rome go by."
The cardinal smiled, never an encouraging development.
"Actually, Carlo, I prefer the view of Rome from the windows of the Apostolic Palace."
With that he turned and walked away. A moment later, he vanished into the darkness.
This book is continued on Disc 5.